from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. 40 years ago this week, 918 people died at Jonestown, a settlement in Guyana created by the People's Temple Church. Until 9/11, it was the largest loss of U.S. civilian life in a deliberate act. Victims, many from the Bay Area, were drawn to Jonestown by leader Jim Jones and his promise of a utopian society with racial and gender equality.
If you believe in me, I will cause the kingdoms of this racist society to become the kingdoms of socialistic freedom. I will cause your desert to blossom as a rose.
But that promise ended in what Jones called an act of revolutionary suicide, and we'll talk about the Jonestown tragedy and the profound impact the mass death had on the Bay Area next, after this. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This week marks the 40th anniversary of the tragedy at Jonestown, a settlement in Guyana created by the People's Temple Church, led by charismatic leader Jim Jones. People from all walks of life, many from the Bay Area, were drawn to Jonestown, which promised a utopian society of racial and social equity and equality. And on November 18, 1978, 918 people died, a third of them children, after Jones instructed them to drink cyanide in what he called an act of revolutionary suicide, protesting an inhumane world. This hour, we'll talk with a journalist and three survivors of Jonestown. Julia Shears joins us first. She's a journalist and author of A Thousand Lives, The Untold Story of Jonestown. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you had exposure actually fairly recently to some FBI documents that were simply not in the public eye for quite some time, and you brought this into your book, and it's very important because maybe you can help us navigate, first of all, to what happened in Jonestown. I mean, many people have called it a mass suicide.
Right.
Many people call it mass murder. You hear suicide, murder, you hear murder, suicide. More light from these documents, where do we go?
So the central argument of my book is that it was mass murder. And in fact, one of the things that these documents revealed was a clear plan by Jim Jones to kill people, this ideation with revolutionary suicide and wanting to kill people as a way to make a statement, from the time he was in San Francisco all the way down to the time he moved to Guyana.
And he was one of these world-ending type of thinkers, too, to a great extent. I don't want to put too much emphasis on Jim Jones because I want to talk about sort of the more faceless people, and they're a lot of the focus of your book. But he was someone who pretty much believed in nuclear holocaust. That's why he moved to Ukiah. That's why he went to Jonestown.
Exactly. Well, he also, in my argument in my book, is because he had this suicidal ideation from early on. At first, he sent one of his lovers to flight school to learn how to fly an airplane. There was an idea bantered about loading people onto this plane and crashing it. They also thought about loading people onto a bus and driving it off the Golden Gate Bridge. And then when the possibility of having a settlement in Guyana came up, where he could sequester almost 1,000 people, that was for him a way to kill many more people and make a much bigger statement. And that's, again, this is all based on these FBI materials that were revealed only recently.
But the statement was what? The statement was that this is an inhumane world and that they're out to get me and that if I'm going to go, I'm going to take all these people with me?
The statement was never clear. It changed. The point is that he had this death wish. He really wanted to, I would call it an extreme measure of loyalty. But he wanted, and he talked about frequently about killing people as a way to make a statement for socialism, against capitalism. It was always a little bit nebulous.
What's also nebulous, though, is the notion that many people had, and I think your book points out that the media had a good deal to do with this,
yes,
that people went to their death willingly and of volition, that they gave poison to their infants and babies because of their being so enamored of this leader that they called father, and they were, in fact, a cult. And therefore, it was seen as a kind of brainwashing, yes, but right, people's will was involved.
Right. And that is something I hope that my book corrects, because, again, you have to realize that, you know, Jim Jones allowed people to believe that they could come and join this experimental community in South America and that they could leave at any time if they didn't like it. They could come back. But when they got there, after a two-day river journey, he took away their passports, he took away their money, and he told them that if they didn't like it, they could swim home because he wasn't paying their way home. And from there, it only got worse. He censored all of the incoming and outgoing mail to make sure people were only painting this glorious version of what Jonestown was like, to make it sound like a success, when actually it was an absolute failure at every level.
Let me bring Yolanda Williams into this. She's a San Francisco police officer. She was at Jonestown in 1977, managed to get out, and it's quite a story you have, Yolanda, and I want to hear about it. I think our listeners will want to hear about it. But I mean, you were very taken by and taken in, as so many people were, thinking this is a leader who can take us to the promised land or at least some kind of utopia, right?
Absolutely. The things that were so attractive about the church is the fact that it focused on social justice, equality, and civil rights, and the fact that we were following a leader who at the time was very articulate and had access to major politicians and activists, including even Huey Newton, Angela Davis, Dennis Banks, and the list just went on and on and on. Being a young person and then growing up in the church as a teenager, it just made me be more committed to what I thought was a movement that was going to be in the positive direction.
I think you said you thought you were maybe joining something like the Peace Corps or something along those lines, creating a better world and fostering community and feeling this community connection.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So when you went to Jonestown, you got a very different picture, right? You thought you were in a concentration camp?
I went to Jonestown, it was a nightmare. My experience was that it was indeed like a concentration camp and armed guards. My passport was immediately stripped from my personal possession. And then I was even asked if I had any U.S. dollars. Fortunately, I did not turn those over. But again, we lost all freedom and access to the outside world, and we had no way of communicating back with those that we had left, our loved ones in the United States.
So you were able, unlike the tragic fate of over 900, close to 1,000 people, to escape. How?
Yes. Well, actually, I was able to smuggle a letter that I had written to my mother through Jimmy Jones Jr. And my mother was in Florida as a greeter for those members going over to Guyana before they boarded the last plane to leave the United States. And in this letter, I told her the truth as to what we were experiencing. And I told her I needed her to come immediately. Do not turn over her passport. Come with thousands of dollars so that we could get emergency passports for myself, my daughter, and my then husband. And it was that letter that summons my mother to come over to an unknown location searching for me. And ultimately, we got in contact and communication with Jim Jones once she arrived. And he was in his drug-induced state of mind. And so we were able to negotiate over a period of 3 to 4 days for him to let me and my husband and my daughter free and go back to the United States.
Yolanda Williams is with us. She was in Jonestown back in 1977, managed to get out. It was 4 months in Jonestown. And I remember on the 25th anniversary, you said, we were sick, but we didn't know we were sick. That kind of epitomizes much of it. And I want to bring us up to the present because there's a church in East Oakland which has a plaque. Jim Jones' name was on that plaque, and you were very upset about this.
Yes, yes. That is the plaque that has the names of all of the victims, the 917 members that were victims of the racial genocide. That's what I refer to it as. And I'm appalled that his name would even be added to that list to make 918 names. I still say there are only 917 names that should be on that plaque.
Well, you were one of the lucky ones. I mean, you used your own resources, obviously, to get out, but so many didn't get out. On the other hand, Tom Bogue got out. He was a Georgetown survivor. He's now current mayor of Dixon. And Tom Bogue, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you.
Let's talk about your experiences there. I mean, it's interesting. Yolanda's a police officer. You're a mayor. I mean, a lot of this is kind of way behind you, one might think. And yet it stays with you, doesn't it?
It actually does. You know, after you experience something like that, there's a part of your life that is forever affected by it. Everything from your viewpoints to looking at where society is going today.
What do you think of most of all when you think of the reasons that you became so involved in Jonestown? And what about the experience of actually being there?
Well, considering the fact that I was a very young man at the time, I didn't have a whole lot of choices as far as involvement. My parents had joined back when I was like 4 years old.
So it was always pretty much a part of your life from early childhood onward. You had no choice, but tell us about the experience itself and what stayed with you now the most.
What stayed with me the most now?
Yeah.
You know.
And then I want to hear. Then I want to hear about why you left and how you escaped. But now, for the moment, tell us what's stayed with you. This is 40 years, after all.
You know, I've thought about that a lot, and the way things have impacted me to this day. And for the longest time, you know, I kind of felt, you know, like maybe, you know, there was just something different about me. But come to find out, it's actually a pretty common phenomenon that it's called the survivor's mentality.
You mean that sense of guilt that you survived and others didn't?
No, I have no guilt about that whatsoever.
Good, yeah.
And there's reasons for that kind of makes things a little bit different for me. But I just mean in terms of when you see chaos starting to come on all around you, you tend to start, you know, thinking in a survivalist mode again. And it's just interesting in the way that continues to impact me to this day. Yeah, and a perfect example is like back in 2008 when we had, you know, our big recession. Okay, and that's when I first realized that was still a part of my inner personality trait. Is when things start going bad, you start automatically thinking, you know, you fall into, how am I going to survive this? What do I need to do? You know, it almost a panic sets in. And back in 2008, when it hit me, it actually hit me hard enough where I just stopped back, you know, set myself back and say, look, this isn't as it appears. You know, it's not as bad as all that. You're just, I really don't know how to say it other than say, you know, you're just acting out of a survivor mentality for having gone through what you've gone through.
So when you feel the walls caving in, you have to go through that inner dialogue and get yourself grounded again. I'm hearing certainly the strong element of what you're saying here. But let me get back to how you escaped and why you left. And then we have a cut that I want you to hear as well.
Okay. Well, I was, you know, it's kind of a hard thing to express because when you think about children and the way they get into things, you know, for a lot of it, you know, if you weren't part of that group, you know, it would have been just, oh, you know, just mischievous, young kid, you know, grow out of it, right? But for there, it was entirely different. So almost anything and everything I did landed me in trouble of some kind. So I was one of the kids who was constantly being disciplined in many fashions, and
including physical abuse, right?
Yeah, as I was gonna say, it tortured, if you want to go to that far, to that extent. I mean, I've experienced everything from beatings to being having chains and shackles welded onto my ankles with another kid. So part of that, I guess, is really the real drive behind not wanting to be there, not wanting to be part of that. That's why I was running away a lot, you know, as early as 9 years old.
Every time you ran away, you were also physically punished, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and tortured again. Yeah.
And so, yeah, so when the opportunity came up to actually get away, and since my father was involved in that action, you know, it was a real spark of hope. I mean, up until that point, it was always, you know, you go to bed at night hoping you didn't wake up in the morning.
Let me actually have you here and have our listeners hear a cut of, this is Jim Jones, and he's talking directly to you. Let's hear.
Did you not think that this government is our ally?
Yes, Father.
Well, what did you think? How did you manage to think you were going to get in Venezuela with the government alerted? I've alerted every person in this government, from the prime minister on down. The border patrol said if you tried to cross, you'd be shot.
That was Father Jones, as you called him, right? He liked that title, and he welcomed that title, telling you what was going to happen to you for trying to escape.
Absolutely.
Well, let me go back.
But I will also tell you this, that very episode right there that you just played,
which was just
a very short clip of what all was said during that meeting, is also what caused me to have a real disdain for majority of the people there. And I know they were doing what they were supposed to do, you know, in terms of attacking you and everything else. But at the same time, I really had no feelings for most of the ones there because of that constant barrage since I was a very young child, all the way up to the age of 17.
Certainly can understand that. And again, sorry for what you had to go through. And Julia Shears, this is unfortunately not an uncommon story. What's uncommon is that he managed to escape like Yolanda Williams. Let me ask you what we heard on that tape. We learned a great deal from these tapes, as you said earlier, but why do you think James taped himself or allowed himself to be taped? I mean, is this part of the megalomania like Richard Nixon or something like that?
I believe so. I think he had always had an eye to posterity, and he wanted to go down in history. That's one of the arguments I make in my book. In fact, one of the women that I followed in my book, I follow five of the rank and file members through Jonestown. One of them was a woman named Edith Roller. She was a white, middle-aged woman. She had an MA in creative writing from San Francisco State. And she kept a daily journal of what was going on in People's Temple, and including all of Jim's sermons, she would write down notes. And let me read you a couple of the excerpts. So this is from September 6, 1975, in San Francisco. He told his people, "I love socialism, and I'd be willing to die to bring it about. But if I did, I'd take 1,000 with me." February 7, 1976. "The last orgasm I'd like to have is death, if I could take you all with me." And again, there is this sense, this idea that he is planning what ultimately became this huge tragedy.
It's also nihilism disguised as revolutionary socialism, which I think he got from Huey P. Newton, didn't he?
He did.
Yeah. And what about, let me ask you, Julia, about the stigma. I mean, people continue to have that stigma who went through the Jonestown experience of being, you know, cult members and all the rest that goes with that.
It's heartbreaking. And this goes back to, you know, the first few days of media coverage after Jonestown, when reporters didn't know what was happening. They would make these assumptions about what happened in Jonestown based on nothing. And they assumed that people were just calmly lining up and drinking this poison punch. And this idea of people voluntarily killing themselves, calmly lining up, has stayed grounded in the American mind, unfortunately.
There's also, we have many young listeners who don't know the story or are completely unfamiliar with it. We ought to say that Jim Jones descended into a kind of lunacy and madness, and much of it drug-induced, terrible paranoia and so forth. But there was all this training, too. They went through white knights, they called them, right?
Right, correct. So here, the biggest thing that, you know, I discovered in my book was that although his inner circle, which was majorly white, his closest aides knew about his desire.
He was going to have equality for all black people, but his upper hierarchy was all white
people. They were. Yeah. And they knew about his plans to kill everyone. But it wasn't until he had everyone sequestered in the middle of the jungle, cut off from the world, that he first brought up this idea of revolutionary suicide to the entire congregation for the first time.
Here's Jim Jones on the actual day.
We've set an example for others. We've set 1,000 people who say we don't like the way the world is. Take our life from us. We laid it down. We got tired. We didn't commit suicide. We committed an act of revolutionary suicide protesting the conditions of an inhumane world.
Yolanda Williams, did you buy into that?
After I got out, definitely not. But I have to admit, while a member of People's Temple and being actively involved, many times we were asked how many of us would be willing to give our life for the cause. And I, like everyone else, raised my hand. However, when I heard this tape, there was no way I would believe what he was saying. And to this day, I refuse to believe that 917 people willingly stood in line waiting to take a dose of this poison, because multiple occasions he had told us after we had consumed something or drank something that what would you do if it was poison? And people would sit there. No one would make a movement because you don't want to be the one that looks like you're afraid or you're going to run from what you've dedicated your lives to. So I really believe that no one ever imagined he would have really killed them or asked them to kill themselves.
Talking about the tragedy of Jonestown 40 years after, and if you have memories of People's Temple or a personal connection to someone lost, we'd like to hear from you, and let me invite you to join us now. Our toll-free number is available, and we welcome your calls. And you can join us at that toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. Please feel free to be part of the program. Again, 866-733-6786 is the number to call. You can also email us, forum at kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at kqedforum. Julia Shear in studio with us, author of 1,000 Lives, The Untold Story of Jonestown. Thomas Bogue on the line, Jonestown survivor and current mayor of Dixon, California, and Yolanda Williams here in studio, San Francisco police officer who was at Jonestown in 1977 and managed to get out. We'll hear from you when we return on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the tragedy of Jonestown 40 years after, and we are going to go to your calls and emails here. Let me first bring into this discussion Deborah Layton. She's the author of a book called Seductive Poison, a memoir of her experiences as a high-ranking member of People's Temple, one of those in the inner circle that we were alluding to. They were really all white people, even though Jim Jones had a great number of his constituents who, of course, were African-American and of other people of color. And let me welcome you to the program. Deborah Layton, good to have you.
Thank you.
I guess the place to begin with you is the big question, why? You went there with a lot of idealism in your heart and for good purposes, but you witnessed some pretty dreadful things that you've written about. It was almost like a gulag in many ways that you were going through, and you had all this, you watched all this fake healing and knew it was fake healing and watched them sexually exploiting people and abusing children. Why did you stay? Why did you continue to believe in him?
Well, you know, I think it's easy to look back from where you are now, but it's, you know, when you're in something like this, it's not unlike young people who are now coming forward about the priests that molested them. You are in this frame of mind believing that what your thoughts are not as good as that person's, your minister, your sports coach. And you're willing to take a sidestep and listen to them because he's, you know, Jones, his whole thing, and Tommy and Yolanda were saying it beautifully. You know, he made you think that you were lesser of a person and less educated and not as highly evolved. And so because we were lesser, it made more sense to listen to him. As we saw things happen that were frightening, he would take you aside and talk to you privately. I know that was hard. I know that was hard for you to see, but don't you understand? You know, if he were allowed to do that again, then this would happen. So he would take people aside, and you thought you knew more. You thought he was talking to you specifically, when really the whole time it was just a huge mind game.
Well, that mind game, if I dare say so, worked pretty well with you. You've said that you would have been out there on the tarmac like your brother was with a rifle. You were a good little soldier. I think that's what.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I wanted out. I desperately wanted to escape. But I also believed that there were mercenaries in the jungle and they were coming in to kill us. You know, Jim had different kids go out at night, none knowing the others were doing it, you know, shooting off guns. And then he would say, they're coming in, they're coming in. And he'd say, we have to, you know, take the children first. We don't want them to torture the children. You know, he had this so well thought out that it is frightening now, especially, you know, 40 years hence. But I knew I wanted out. But I also had I escaped. But had Leo Ryan come in, I would never have gone out with him because I believed he was a CIA agent. You know, Jones had us believing, and it's very much like our society now. There has been a true culting of America. And if you look at Trump or the very, very, very left, you know, it's us against them. Our way is the only right way. And that the end justifies the means. That is happening right now. Jones was like Hitler. Hitler was able to take a group of people and frighten them into following, because if even the good German youth didn't follow, they knew their parents might be put in a concentration camp. That's how Jim kept every single person in line, because all of us had family there.
So you're saying that fear was a terribly strong factor, obviously, in keeping you there.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and you couldn't and you couldn't escape from inside Jonestown anyway. It was, you know, 250 miles away from civilization in the middle of a clear jungle that took 24 hours over the ocean, 9 hours up a river, another 2 hours down a road in a truck.
I'm struck also, though, by the title of your book, Seductive Poison. What was seductive about it? Was it just that idealism that supposedly was fostered, especially in light of the fact that, you know, he was talking about the children having to be protected, but you witnessed children being abused and beaten, didn't you?
Well, that was much later. I mean, so the seductive part was, you know, I was in boarding school in England. I came home. I was 18 years old. I was in boarding school in England because I was a pain in the, you know, rear end to my parents. I was a liar. They couldn't trust a thing I said. And it was just the 60s, you know, and everybody was cutting school and going to the campus and watching, you know, people fight. And so when I came home, just for a six-week visit for summer break, I was invited to come to a meeting in San Francisco, and it was this person that was known as a civil rights leader, and he was written about in the Chronicle all the time, and he was the head of the Human Rights Commission, and then he became the head of the San Francisco Housing Commission. Jim Jones was so well, you know, laden with wonderful compliments from the world, everybody, you know, even our dignitary said, you know, he should have a Nobel Prize for Peace. Nobody knew who he was. But when I came to that first meeting and afterwards, he came up to me and he said, I felt an energy when you walked into this room. You have qualities your parents don't even recognize, and it's you. It's you who I need in this organization. We can make such a difference. Well, hell, you know, at 17, 18, it was like, oh, my God, a grown-up thinks I'm special. And it is seductive. And that's what all these organizations and groups now do. We have cults throughout America now, groups that we know as culty type of groups, and then just the far, far, you know, right. And it's, if you leave, you will be hurt. Nobody wants, in any of these groups, and you can put any name on any of them, it's even in happening in, you know, New York with the Hasidics. If you leave, you will never see your children again. You'll never see your mother or your father.
Well, indeed. But one thinks of the irony that of swallowing that poison and believing that when your mother died of cancer, perhaps to a great extent because Jim Jones had taken her medication and hidden it from you and took charge of it, hidden from her whole family. And your brother is still in prison, I believe, for being out there on the tarmac shooting at Congressman Ryan and those who came to Jonestown.
Yeah, actually, my brother didn't shoot Leo Ryan, but that is not even part of this topic, and he didn't go to prison for that. But he was in prison for 20 years, and he is now out. I was far more culpable than my brother. You know, Jones was angry that I blew the whistle on the organization, that I went to Washington, D.C., that I spoke before the State Department, that I had I was with Leo Ryan and Jackie Speer in New York 2 days before they flew down to Guyana. And my affidavit specifically says that Jones is planning to kill everybody, the babies first. But people now kind of get that. But then, 40 years ago, nobody has ever heard of a death cult. You know, all these other things came much later. And it is the death, you know, People's Temple Jim Jones coined that definition. Before that, no one had any idea.
And again, Deborah Layton is the author of Seductive Poison. It's a memoir of her experience as a high-ranking member of the People's Temple. I'm glad she's called attention to the political support that Jim Jones got right here in San Francisco from many political leaders, including former assassinated mayor George Moscone and Willie Brown and others who are still held in high esteem. Let me get our callers on here, and let me begin with Judy. Judy, you're on.
Hello?
Yes, hi, you're on the air.
Judy Liebeloff? Hi, Michael. Thank you.
Former student of mine, who's written a book on Jonestown.
And hi, Julia and Deborah, and hi, Tom and Yolanda. I've met you too. I wanted to say, well, the producer asked me to read a poem of the students from my book, and so I'm going to read an excerpt from that. I guess I'll start with that.
The students being students. I'm sorry, Judy, to interrupt you. Students who were indeed who had experienced Jonestown. Yeah.
No, I was their teacher from 1976 to the summer of 1977. Mm-hmm. And
before Jonestown,
where I taught.
Yeah.
Yeah. Opportunity 2 was a small 300-student school where Jim Jones sent all the People's Temple kids, about 80 of them as far as we can figure out, and the book, and then they were gone. Which is, by the way, on the cover of the Chronicle Bait book today, is about 28 of the kids that we knew best. Another teacher and I, Ron Cabral, did the book together, and focuses on 15. And this was a poem from my creative writing class that had non-Temple kids and Temple kids in it. And now, today, it's an eerily haunting poem. So I thought it would be a good one to read. And of course, they could know nothing about how prophetic their poem would seem. If there were a window in the sky, I would see spirits of dead in dreams, gossiping gods, spirits of dead deeds, spirits of war gods, thunder gods, spirits of mothers who have lost their babies, weeping, spirits of all the helpless things, spirits of brown grizzly bears, spirits of infants taken before their time.
Judy, thank you.
Thank you. And you mentioned faceless people, and I think the young people are the very most faceless. They had little or no choice in whether or not to go to Jonestown. And few people I find realize that a third of those who died in Jonestown were under 18, and a half were in their 20s or younger, like Deb. And I think also that people don't realize that even though it's a tragic, terrible, horrific story, there is some hope in it. There's people like Tom who kept trying and trying and trying to get escape, even if he got punished. There's Deborah who got out to try to tell the story. Mm-hmm. And there's the spirit of the young people in Jonestown that I discovered when I did my research, who also just refused to not love other people, which Jones didn't think was a good idea. Relationships were planned by him, but they would fall in love and have secret meetings. They had dances that were forbidden on the basketball court out in the middle of the jungle in the dark of the night.
Judy, excuse me for interrupting you here. I'm glad you called. I do have to move things along, though, and I'm glad you got at least into the conversation here and talked about your book, and I appreciate your calling. I want to go back to Tom Bogue, though, because we only have about a minute or two with him. And I'll get your response, Tom, to something that's written here by a listener. This is Luanda, who says, I remember the day and night of this horrible event as I listened to the gentleman, that's you, Tom, he mentioned today, and I thought, yes, hopelessness, people following a bad leader. Is this not today? We heard from Julia Shears talking about, Deborah Layton talking about analogies to our present day. Do you, as a mayor, as a public official, see those?
I'm going to say, in listening to Deborah Layton, she really touched upon it greatly. And I really appreciate a lot of things that she has just said. Because when you think about the condition of our society back in the 60s when this first started up, we are in nearly the same exact situation as a society today, and which also makes it very ripe for people to fall into the same trap, especially this being so 40 years later and having forgotten what occurred then and the whys. So Deborah really touched upon it. And I just want to take a quick moment to express my gratitude to Julia Shears, who did a fantastic book, really touched upon it. She had a way of expressing, things that occurred in a way that people can understand. Judy Belair, I read her book also. And I would really like to say that I don't think you really get the full story without getting both of their books. I've been extremely intrigued by both. I've learned a great deal more than I knew before by reading both of them. And so, yes, but to get back to your original question.
I just wondered, because when you talked about the recession sort of bringing you back to feelings of chaos, if you get those feelings now in the political world we're living in.
Those feelings do occur now, because once again, our economics and society are leading towards chaos again, where you have, states against states, states against federal government against states. I mean, these are extremes that I don't believe we've seen before. I mean, prior to the revolution. And so this does create a level of anxiety with me. I mean, it is nothing that is going to, cause me to, act in extreme measures of fear. But it does create great concern in terms of our society pulling away from each other instead of coming together.
Well, Tom Bogue, it's good to have you with us this morning on Forum, and I appreciate very much your being with us. Good luck to you. Thank you.
And thank you very much for having me on the air. Tom, and to your listeners.
Tom Bogue, again, is a Jonestown survivor, current mayor of Dixon, California. Let me bring some more callers on, and we go next to Nimat. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, you're on the air.
Thank you. So I just wanted to, and I hear an echo in the back, but I just wanted to talk about my experience when I was probably about 12 years old. I was a member of the Black Muslim community, and so we would go to Temple 26, which was on Geary. It was right next door to Jim Jones Temple. And so me and my girlfriend, we would sneak over to Jim Jones Temple because they'd have oftentimes have food over there.
Right.
So we'd go over there and we'd look at their I guess their services. And I was just really surprised because, you know, they wore uniforms, kind of, you know, we wore uniforms and they wore these red and black uniforms. And the way the people who were seemed to be in charge and the people who were closest to Jim Jones, definitely white. The majority of the congregation was African-American, a lot of elderly people. And I remember when the people in charge, I guess they were lieutenants and captains, when they saw that we were from the temple next door, they were like, oh, you have to meet Father. You know, so they, you know, brought us to him, and he was sitting in this big chair, and they actually put me on his lap, which was very odd. And, you know, I looked at him, and he just, he truly appeared to be under the influence. And I just kind of looked at that, and I was like, you know, first of all, my mom knew I was there. She would choke me. But other than that, I said, I don't want any parts of this. And I saw how they talked to some of the congregation, horribly mean. I was like, I'm out of here. And so I didn't come back. And yes, I was there when they had the white knight.
The drills.
The drills, the white knight drills, where they would have you drink that Kool-Aid, which I wasn't going to drink because I didn't know where it came from.
Of course, it wasn't actually Kool-Aid. People talk now all this banality about they drink the Kool-Aid and all, but was it Julia Shears?
It was Flavor-Aid.
It was Flavor-Aid,
a knockoff, essentially.
Yes. So that was my little experience.
Well, Nima, thank you for that story. It's good to hear from you, and I appreciate your call. And let me go to you on that, Deborah Layton. Certainly many of those African-Americans were well aware that things were being, for the most part, controlled by white people.
You know, I don't think it people thought that then. I didn't. I think we're just too innocent. I think every single person, I mean, Yolanda can tell you this, every single person that joined People's Temple were idealistic. They wanted to do something important in the world, and he surrounded himself on the pulpit with African American, you know, his assistant was Archie Innes, this beautiful, you know, 7 foot tall black man, and his entire family were very, very involved in the church. So I never saw it. Any racism in that sense. Looking back now, I don't think he chose to bring black people into the organization. He brought people from Indiana that were poor initially, and I think the way he did it is he realized that people would listen to him speak because he must have studied Martin Luther King because he spoke like that. He had a beautiful voice. Is that you, Yolanda, saying yeah?
Yes. In fact, Jim Jones made it a point to do a lot of reading and listening to audible tapes. He even went to the extreme of Father Divine's movement, Reverend Ike, A.A. Allen, Edgar Casey. All of these were books and people that he practiced and he rehearsed, and so he was very accomplished actor to say he had not gone to professional acting school. But I wanted to roll back to something that...
Can I just ask you a quick question about that? Because a listener wants to know about what his connection was to Cecil Brown. Was he...
Cecil Williams?
Excuse me. Was he influenced by Cecil Williams, you know? Or did he imitate him?
He and Cecil were friends. And he saw the way Cecil ran his church, and it gave him ideas how to further advance himself. Cecil was more of someone that he felt he needed to have just as much power, and then ultimately he succeeded in having more power and control in the city and county of San Francisco than Cecil had. But I wanted to roll back to something that Judy had said when she was on the air. She alluded to the story of Debbie and the story of Tommy Boak, but she did not say anything about the story of Yolanda Williams. This is a continuous problem about this whole People's Temples movement. The majority of the members were Black. Mm-hmm. We deserve and we have a right to be heard. And in this 40th anniversary that is occurring here in San Francisco on Sunday, November 18th, it is specifically for that. We want to reclaim our heritage, and we are able to speak for ourselves, and we appreciate you here at KQAD giving the opportunity for the Black voices to be heard, and specifically the women.
Well, they were more of the voices than anybody else in the People's Temple, and also more of them from right here in the Bay Area, we should add. And let me get another caller on here. And let me go next to a caller from Vallejo. That's you, Bob. You're on. Good morning.
Yes. How did Tom escape? He never got to that.
I'm sorry. I apologize for that, because I did ask him about it. Julia can tell that story, I think. Julia Shears, about how Tom Boak escaped.
Sure. So ultimately, Tom tried to run away with another boy named Ryan Davis in November 1977. That's the audio tape we heard after they were caught. They got out into the jungle, and once it became night, they couldn't see in front of their faces. So they went back to the main road where the Jonestown guards captured them and brought them in before the pavilion and the audio where they're being confronted by Jim Jones. So a year later, the next November, when Congressman Leo Ryan came to investigate claims that people were being held against their will, the second day he was there, there was a group of people who decided to leave with him. And Tom, his father, his mother, and a couple of his sisters went out with Congressman Leo Ryan.
And interestingly enough, when I went to Jonestown, when we first arrived in Guyana with my husband, Tommy Boak was put into a ditch that was 6 feet deep. And we were told not to go near him, not to try and talk to him, or we would be punished. And the reason he was subjected to that type of torture and punishment was because he had tried to escape through the jungle.
He was also punished for, as I understand it, perhaps you can clarify this, Julie Shears, for all kinds of petty and trivial kinds of things, taking food from a table, for example. I mean, punished pretty severely.
Yeah, right? At one point he planted a watermelon seed and grew a watermelon for himself, and that was considered anti-revolutionary, thinking just about himself and not about the group, and so he was punished for that.
Yeah, you can't be selfish. And that would have been considered an act of selfishness.
This is while Jim Jones was accumulating great wealth and doing all kinds of things that showed selfishness and acquisitiveness and megalomania. Let me get another caller on here. Let me get Kevin on quickly. Kevin, go ahead.
Hello. Yes, I'm calling on behalf of the licensees of the Flavor Aid brand. No, I'm joking. My quick question is, I just wanted to know, what was the situation with the Guyanese government? Did they understand what was going on? Did they cooperate? Did they help in any way?
Important question. Yeah. Julia Shears?
I'll answer that. Maybe Yolanda has something to add. So the problem was is that People's Temple claimed to be a church, right? And so once they were in Guyana and people, the concerned relatives back in San Francisco and California, contacted the embassy and asked them to look after their loved ones in Jonestown, it became a First Amendment issue, this freedom of religion, right? So the embassy was limited in as far as what it could do in investigating Jonestown. They would send representatives up to Jonestown and ask him, are you planning on killing everyone in Jonestown? And Jim Jones would look at them as if they were nuts and say, what are you talking about? Of course not. So he just denied.
And you want to add something, Yolanda Williams?
Also, it was a plan when we had gotten there that there would be certain women, white females, that would be dating and become involved with Guyanese officials and the ones who were closest to Forbes Burnham. And one, Paula Adams, was one in particular. And they knew in advance when the Guyanese representatives would be coming into Jonestown. So they, of course, would then be prepared to stage things so that it looked like everything was just going on normal like any other missionary project. And you have to also understand that People's Temple represented major revenue for the Guyanese government. And that alone for a country that was so financially destitute was important.
We're going to have to leave it there. Yolanda Williams, Lieutenant Williams, thank you for joining us. Good to have you with us. Yolanda Williams was in Jonestown in 1977, managed to get out. Good to have you, Julia Shears. Thank you for being part of this program.
Thank you.
Julia Shears is a journalist and author of A Thousand Lives, The Untold Story of Jonestown. And we thank you, Deborah Layton. Deborah Layton was with us this hour as well. Good to have you.
Thank you. Tomorrow night we're doing a book talk, and it'd be great if Yolanda came in Oakland, California at 7 p.m.
Where specifically?
It's called East Bay Books. It's on College Avenue near Broadway.
Okay, and thank you again, Deborah Layton. Her book is Seductive Poison, a memoir of her experience as a high-ranking member in the People's Temple. And we thank Tom Bogue for being with us as well, another Jonestown survivor and current mayor of Dixon. And thank you, our listeners. We would not be here without you. And stay tuned for more on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.